SBS Radio.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV broadcasts from, Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and their elders, past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from freshwater to saltwater.
Hello and welcome to NITV Radio. You're with Bertrand Tungandame and I'm very happy to be your host today. Now, coming up in your program, academic, advocate, singer and filmmaker Tiriki Onas will join us to talk about Ablaze, his feature-length documentary telling the extraordinary life of his grandfather, Yota Yota Wiradjuri man Bill Onas. Bill Onas was the first Aboriginal filmmaker, a heroic cultural and political figure who revived his people's culture in the 40s and ignited a civil rights movement that would, against enormous odds, change the course of history. The program also features Jason Aids, exploring Welcome to Country, a not-for-profit organization aiming to create an environment for First Nations businesses, especially in the tourism sector, to thrive. We stay in the tourism sector, looking at a theatre production like no other, a cultural walk retracing a path travelled by Aboriginal freedom fighters who valiantly resisted colonisation in the early 19th century during what's known as the Black Wars. But first, the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside
Parliament. The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Bulletin, the trial of a Northern Territory policeman accused of murdering an Aboriginal teenager is proceeding within COVID-19 health measures. Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg says the government will make COVID-19 test expenses tax deductible for businesses and individuals using them for work. And Tasmanian Liberal MP Bridget Archer says she'll vote against the federal government's religious discrimination bill. Awaited trial of a Northern Territory policeman accused of murdering an Aboriginal teenager will run for under 4 hours a day in line with COVID-19 health measures. Constable Zachary Rolfe has pleaded not guilty to the shooting murder of Kumanjai Walker in November 2019. The 19-year-old died after allegedly being shot 3 times in the remote community of Uendumu, 290 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. The Supreme Court trial in Darwin, which has been postponed 3 times, twice due to COVID-19, is scheduled to start today when the jury is impaneled. The Aboriginal flag will fly permanently on top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet says it will happen as soon as possible, and the New South Wales government has been working through this for some time. He says he first received advice that getting the flag hoisted would take 2 years, but this will be sped up.
In the 1920s, it took 9 years to build the Harbour Bridge, but apparently today it takes 2 years to put a flagpole on top of the Harbour Bridge. I mean, I'll climb up there myself and put it up if I need to. I mean, this is, the government departments need to work faster, and I can't see why it would take that long. And the new advice that I've received is that time frame can be expedited. I think it went down to 2 years and then to 6 months. So as soon as possible.
Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has announced the government will make COVID-19 test expenses tax deductible for businesses and individuals who use them for work purposes. The proposed changes will be backdated to apply from the beginning of 2021 to 2022 financial year and cover both PCR and rapid antigen tests. It means a worker with a marginal tax rate of 32.5% will receive a refund of about $6.50 for every 2 pack of rapid tests purchased for $20. Mr. Frydenberg says the tests are an important tool in assisting businesses to protect their workforce and ensure they can keep their doors open.
Rapid antigen tests for work-related purposes will now be completely tax deductible, and the fringe benefits tax will not apply to businesses who supply those RAT tests to their workers.
Non-urgent elective surgery will recommence in New South Wales today, and such surgeries were suspended on the 10th of January to free up spaces in hospitals for COVID-19 patients. Health Minister Brad Hazard says the private hospitals and public health sector are now working together towards getting elective surgeries back up to 75% of the pre-pandemic levels. He has thanked those who had to postpone their operations.
I know it's pretty tough, particularly if you've got a knee that's bothering you or a hip or one of the items of surgery, cataract surgery, one of the items that has had to be put off for a few weeks. I apologise on behalf of the health system, but I also know that each of us would understand that in a 100-year pandemic, we've had to take measures that allowed for the possibility of those patients coming into our system.
It comes as New South Wales records a further 14 deaths, with 137 people currently in ICU. There are 7,437 new cases today and 2,099 people in hospital. In the meantime, Victoria is set to pass a vaccination milestone today, with 50% of children aged 5 to 11 having received their first dose. Deputy Premier James Marlino says while this is an encouraging step forward, there's still a way to go in protecting Victorians from COVID-19. It comes as the state records 7 deaths and 8,275 new cases of COVID-19. Mr. Marlino is continuing to urge Victorians to come forward for their vaccinations.
Over the next 7 days, there are 107,000 appointments available. So please, if you haven't had your third dose, if your child hasn't had their first paediatric dose, please make an appointment either at our state-run clinics or via our GPs and our community pharmacies.
There are currently 638 people in hospitals across Victoria, including 72 in the ICU. Queenslanders will no longer need to use the check-in app to enter venues across the state, though proof of COVID-19 vaccination will still be required in places that ask for it. The state has recorded 19 deaths, and there are 663 people in public hospitals, including 41 in the ICU. Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says health authorities believe Queensland is now coming off the peak of COVID cases. Still in Queensland, children are returning to class today, with the authorities stating COVID-19 outbreaks in schools are inevitable, but it's unlikely they will close. The return to school was delayed by 2 weeks in the state due to the current virus wave, with 5,746 new infections and 9 deaths reported on Sunday. Less than half of children under 11 in Queensland have had one dose of the vaccine, and rapid antigen tests are still being sent to schools. Face masks are mandatory in high schools and strongly recommended for students in years 3 to 6, while schools must ensure adequate classroom ventilation. The government had promised to provide schools with free rapid antigen tests but it's unclear whether they have arrived in time. Tasmania is preparing for children to return to school on Wednesday, February 9, as the state records 443 new COVID cases and no deaths. There are 15 people in hospital with COVID-19, including 8 being treated specifically for virus symptoms and 1 person in the ICU. Tasmanian Premier Peter Godwin says parents should be assured by the fact that classrooms are well ventilated and that outdoor learning spaces are being used.
The arrangements for schools have been under construction now for a number of months. We've had an acting minister in place, and parents can have confidence that the plan has been developed and implemented and that our schools are ready to go when their children return on Wednesday.
Peter Godwin also said that Education Minister Sarah Courtney, who contracted COVID after a holiday in France, has recovered from the virus and will return to work on Thursday, February 10. Tasmanian Liberal MP Bridget Archer says she will vote against the federal government's religious discrimination bill as debate on the issue continues. The member for Bass says she can't support the proposed legislation in its current form, citing concerns it will override state anti-discrimination laws protecting LGBTIQ plus students. It comes as the federal opposition calls on Prime Minister Scott Morrison to introduce amendments to the bill to ensure students can't be unfairly expelled on the basis of their sexuality or gender identity. The Bass Communications spokeswoman, Michelle Rowland, says while her party is still considering the recommendations from the two committees that examine the bill, protecting students would get bipartisan support.
We would want to examine this very carefully. This is a complex area and one that has been obviously deeply scrutinised by people who have particular views on this, a very wide variety of evidence presented. So, exactly as you said, we will be guided by those principles, but how that manifests itself in the amendments, we will consider those through our normal caucus processes.
Labour MPs and senators in those committees did say they were in favour of the bill being passed, subject to some minor and technical amendments being made. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has urged people to ignore apocalyptic predictions about an imminent Russian invasion. In a tweet, he said, Ukraine has a strong army, unprecedented international support, and Ukrainians' faith in their country. He added, the enemy should be afraid of us, not us of them. A week ago, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said the country was not a sinking Titanic and accused the United States government and media of fueling panic. U.S. officials say that Russia could be ready for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by mid-February, as Moscow had assembled 70% of the military force needed. They also warned that an invasion could lead to the deaths of up to 50,000 civilians and 25,000 Ukrainian soldiers. African Union leaders gathered at a summit in Ethiopia on Saturday are calling for a bigger role on the international stage as the continent grapples with increased coups, COVID-19 and climate change. The union was formed 20 years ago to foster regional cooperation but has taken little action in the face of six coups or attempted coups in the past year and a half. The bloc did not move to suspend Burkina Faso, Mali and Sudan following military takeovers, but it's unclear whether the ban had any effect on those countries' new leaders. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the leaders by video link, repeating calls for ceasefire in the Ethiopian conflict, which broke out in November 2020 and has killed thousands. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says it's unlikely that international assistance could make a change and Africa must look inwards.
The idea once dangled in front of us of a Marshall Plan in favour of the continent has unravelled. I'm not far from thinking that such a plan, though necessary, will never come from the outside. Here, more than ever, the African leadership is forcefully challenged to mobilize internal resources that reveal the immense potential of the continent. This is the only way, an African direction for Africa.
And to sport, Senegal has won its first ever Africa Cup of Nations title with a 4-2 penalty shootout victory against seven-time winners Egypt following a 0-0 draw. Senegal's Sadio Mane had missed an early penalty in the game but stepped up to make history for the West African nation by sealing the win with a penalty goal after the 128th minute. Egypt was also looking to break records with an 8th AFCON win but failed to lead the shootout. And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, partly cloudy 31, Perth, partly cloudy 24, Adelaide, partly cloudy as well 33, Melbourne, a sunny day 29, Hobart, mostly sunny 23, Albury-Wodonga, sunny 27, Canberra, partly cloudy 22, Wollongong, a shower or two 22, Sydney, much the same 25, Newcastle, similar conditions 25 as well, Brisbane, partly cloudy 28, Townsville, mostly sunny 29, Cairns, a shower or two 31, Alice Springs sunny 34, Darwin showers and a possible storm with a top of 31, and the Torres Strait Islands a partly cloudy day and a top of 29. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, share our stories on Facebook.
We continue with Indigenous rights in upcoming topics that we've got coming up next. Academic advocate, singer and filmmaker Tiriki Onus will join us to talk about Ablaze, his feature-length documentary. It's about the story of the extraordinary life of his grandfather, Bill Onus, the first Aboriginal filmmaker and an activist for Indigenous rights. Also in the program, Jason Aids, CEO of not-for-profit organization Welcome to Country, will explore the NGO's work towards creating an environment for First Nations businesses to thrive. We also discover a cultural walk retracing a path traveled by Aboriginal freedom fighters who valiantly resisted colonization in early 19th century during the Black Wars in Tasmania.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Academic, advocate, singer and now filmmaker Tiriki Onus is joining me on NITV Radio to discuss his film, Ablaze, a feature-length documentary about the extraordinary life of his grandfather, Bill Onus. First of all, welcome to NITV Radio, Tiriki.
Thank you so very much. It's an honour to be here.
Now, this film, Ablaze, it's extraordinary about the story that it brings to light. It shines the light on an extraordinary man, not just because he's your grandfather, but he's also a key figure in the Indigenous rights movement. Tell us about the film and your grandfather.
Well, my grandfather, Bill, had always been part of my life growing up, even though he died 12 years before I was born. His story had always lived almost like a myth within our family. And I'd always felt very close to him, but there was so much that I didn't know about him. I knew, for instance, that he had filmed some things, as I thought, and made some films, but I believe they'd all been lost in a caravan fire. And it was only in 2015, I think, that I was contacted by my very dear friend, or my now very dear friend and colleague, Alec Morgan, to say that he'd found a film of Bill's in the archive. For a long time growing up, I'd repeatedly been told by other family and community stories of Bill, and there have been those such as Gary Foley who have frequently informed me that he didn't think that Bill gets his due, doesn't get his credit perhaps for some of the things that he did. But the more I've gone on and the more I've found out about Bill, the more I've realised that he wasn't particularly interested in credit for things either. He was much more interested in working in community and seeing that things happened rather than having his name next to things. But the making of this film was a wonderful opportunity for me to grow a lot closer to someone that I thought I knew, and certainly I think I've created a much deeper relationship with Bill over the course of this time, having found the film in the archive and then going on a detective journey that lasted just over 6 years of slowly filming in dribs and drabs and then doing one big push at the end to bring it all together and finally be able to give it to the world, even in the middle of a pandemic.
This movie, you say it began when you first heard from a colleague about the film that he'd made, but you also had a chance discovery in a suitcase, something that you know, people find things accidentally or just randomly, but this was a really powerful discovery that led you to this detective work, that led you to crisscross the country and retrace Bill's journey across the country.
That's right. And excuse me, at times I'm quite taken aback at how much, well, seemingly how much luck there has been in this story as well. I was originally contacted by Alec Morgan, whom I didn't know. I knew his work and I respected his work greatly. Alec has done some extraordinary stuff, and his film Lousy Little Sixpence from 1983 is still an extraordinary piece of Australian film, one which I still use to teach students today. But I'd remembered that there was an old suitcase with Bill's name on it in our house, and it was some time after we'd started making or started this detective work, if you will, of finding out an old fill of bills in the archive and starting to try to work out where it came from, that I remembered this suitcase existed. And went rifling around through the basement of my mother's house and pulled it out and found, incredibly fortunately, that so much of the stories we were looking for were contained therein. They created the links that we thought were there, they reinforced them. We found photos of bills that put him in these places, that put him behind the camera as well as in front of it. And that was an extraordinary, extraordinary happenstance. And indeed, I'm still unpacking a lot of the contents of his old suitcase full of photos and correspondence and archiving and trying to tease out more of these stories. There's so many stories that don't actually make it into the film, but it's been wonderful to find the ones that we have been able to tell, even though we've had to leave a lot on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, and the powerful thing is that Bill was arguably one of the first, if not the first, actually indigenous filmmaker. And as you said, he didn't want to take any credit, but he documented actually a very, very significant part of the Aboriginal human rights movement. And thanks to your work and Bill's work, well, we can see footage of Reg Saunders, Doug Nichols back in the time when they were actually no one was bothering to actually document their fight, their struggle, what they went through at that time. So it brings history to us, actually, to all of us.
Absolutely. And I think that's I went to a showing of the film last night out at Bunjil Place in Narrewarren, where I gave a Q&A. And this is the first time I'd actually seen the film with an audience, because everything else had been done online during COVID. And the resounding response that came back was, well, we didn't know, but now we want to know more. And I think that's been one of the wonderful things of making this film for me, and collaborating with Alec and all of my wonderful colleagues that we did bring together to make this film, has been that we are bringing stories to the surface, and we are hopefully in some small way both highlighting the legacy of these artists and leaving a bit of a legacy ourselves. I hope that more people will go searching and looking and finding more of these stories. If it weren't for someone as dedicated as Alec going and looking in the archive, I wouldn't have known that Bill's film, that any of Bill's films still existed. I thought they'd all been lost. But this isn't just a story about Bill for me. Certainly Bill is a central figure within it, but it's also a story about all of his contemporaries and allies, all of those that he worked with, that nothing happens in a vacuum. Rather, we're incredibly strong when we come together. And there's a wonderful opportunity for us to keep celebrating and telling these stories of allyship and of strength between First Nations people, and indeed with all of the other non-Indigenous people who have come together to support and empower the causes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yeah, you document also the contribution of some African American leaders who came to Australia and spoke for the Indigenous people, because there are strong similarities between what African Americans were going through, their own struggle for their rights, and the struggle for Indigenous rights in Australia. You also document something that most people, wouldn't know about, the life of Indigenous people in Melbourne, in Fitzroy. And you've got some testimony from Auntie Alma Thorpe. They're describing how really appalling the conditions were at the time.
Yes, Auntie Alma Thorpe has just been incredibly generous. She's one of the most beautiful human beings. And to sit with her and hear her stories of the adversity that she and her families faced, and by extension then understanding some of the adversity that Bill and my family were facing at the same time in and around Gore Street and Little George Street, Fitzroy, it's incredibly powerful. And to think that someone like Auntie Alma Thorpe has been so instrumental in the creation of so many of our organisations, of being involved in the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service, of working alongside people like my Uncle Bruce McGuinness, building so much for our community, to see and hear the stories of what people like Auntie Alma had to live through, where they came out of, and similarly, Auntie Faye Carter talking about living up on on the flats outside of Maroochydore. These are the people that built our organisations and our community now, and have had such incredible strength. I'm in awe of it. I'm not sure I would have their strength and their vitality and their drive if I had to struggle through everything that they have. But they carry it with such grace and humility, and still go on to do such extraordinary things.
Yeah, I know the movie tells the story very powerfully, also with the contemporaries of Bill. And also, one thing, we are recording this conversation on the 4th of February, and the 4th of February is actually a very strong date in Aboriginal rights, and not just Aboriginal rights, it's actually workers' rights, because the 4th of February 1939 was the Kamaraganja walk-off.
That's exactly right.
And Bill played a big role in documenting this.
A big, huge role. And of course, in the film, we speak very strongly about the support that Bill gave to the Pilbara strikers as well. And I think that a lot of his admiration for the Pilbara strikers came from him being so involved in the Kamaraganja walk-off years before, in 1939. An extraordinary part of our shared history, and certainly for me and my family and all of my other Yorta Yorta extended family and all those families coming out of Kamaraganja, it is an incredibly important time. Again, when we look at a moment when we drew a line in the sand, when our ancestors and old people drew a line in the sand and said, no, we're not going to put up with this. In fact, we're going to take matters into our own hands, and showed the incredible ingenuity and strength that I think followed many of our activists through that time, of understanding how to manipulate systems, understanding that by sneaking out of New South Wales into Victoria, you were no longer subject to the same laws that you were before. And because you were a ward of the state in New South Wales, you couldn't be held accountable in the same way in Victoria. Incredibly, incredibly ingenious approaches that people like Bill and Jack Patton and Marge Tucker and others took in those days to be able to subvert the legal systems of the dominant culture at the time, to be able to instead make a space for the voice and the power and the sovereignty of our communities to shine through. And then, from there on, to go and use the same artistic and creative practices that had been denied to us, had been made illegal, to then go and put them on stages in front of audiences and hide in plain sight and maintain culture and identity that way, was nothing short of pure genius. I'm incredibly inspired by them all.
And that was academic Tariki Onas talking about Ablaze, his feature-length documentary. Well, Tariki was very generous with his time. We spoke extensively, and the full conversation will actually be published on our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio, later this afternoon. The film Ablaze will screen at Footscray Art Centre next Tuesday, February 15, and the screening will be followed by a Q&A session with the filmmaker.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now, coming up, a conversation with Jason Aids, a CEO of Welcome to Country. Well, Welcome to Country is a not-for-profit organization that focuses on economic development of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. In a conversation with NITV Radio's Shaka Pekova, Jason Aids said that Welcome to Country started when a number of people just came together looking at how to use tech to support Aboriginal businesses to thrive. Then they decided to proceed systematically, starting with the tourism sector.
So Welcome to Country, it came from a number of people kind of coming together. Originally, we were auspiced or a project of First Australians Capital. Initially, the thinking was around how to use tech to support Aboriginal businesses to thrive. And it was through some of the earlier exploration stages of that it was decided that tourism would be the first vertical that would be focused on. Shortly after, I was brought on to lead Welcome to Country, and it moved from being a project to establish our own organisation to manage and run it. So, yeah, it's been quite a journey, but I think the passion, particularly for the organization, is how to use technology to help businesses to focus on what they do best and to give them access to markets that helps them thrive.
You're working in tourism, and of course, tourism was probably one of the most, if not the most, affected by COVID-19 and all the lockdowns and travel restrictions. And also, you launched in 2019 amongst the bushfires. So how did you deal with these challenges?
When you look back in hindsight around what was happening at the time, we certainly had no, line sight to the things that were coming. And I think, nobody really did. And I mean, obviously, the impacts of the bushfires, and then there was the floods that were occurring in Queensland, all had quite a dramatic impact on the tourism industry as a whole. And over time, it's kind of fluctuated in terms of during the early stages of the pandemic and probably into the middle stages, there was a lot of interest in, and there still is a lot of interest in Aboriginal tourism. The challenge was, people being able to access that. And so with borders going up and down at various times, demand was quite high, particularly across northern Australia, as many southerners were seeking to get some of that warmer weather, perhaps, because they couldn't travel overseas like they could before. So demand was quite high. But I think, again, with borders going up and down, that industry has been really heavily hit. And I think that there's a real need to keep focused, to keep promoting Aboriginal tourism, and I think also to give it its spotlight. I'm confident that once the travelling public has confidence in the ability to travel, that borders won't be thrown up and that travels will be thrown into disarray, that we will actually see some awesome comeback, for the industry. But in the meantime, it's kind of weathering the storm somewhat, although many of our operators think their ability to maneuver around this, we've seen some of them, pivot on their ideas in terms of what they're delivering. But nonetheless, it still had a pretty dramatic impact.
Do you think like the recovery is starting now, or do you think we are still, in the deep bad situation now?
We were seeing really positive signs leading into the last kind of broad lockdown. So people were gaining confidence. Coming out of these last round of lockdowns, we also have seen some really good interest, in particular leading into the Christmas period, where people were quite open to doing an Aboriginal experience for their team as a part of their end of year celebrations. I think things have softened somewhat since then, because again, as COVID rises, people are being more cautious around what they're doing. But I'm hopeful, in the next few months that we will see some positive shifts on that front. But I also hope to see some continuing investment, in the industry to help give it its best chance to bounce back.
Let's look at the happier side of that. So what are the programs that tourists are offered?
So we offer, experiences all over the country, firstly, so and in different locations from very remote areas to cities. So here in Sydney, for example, where we're based, there's a wonderful experience at the Botanical Gardens here. And that one in particular has been of high interest to people. The idea, I think, of tasting food and exploring culture in that way is really appealing to people. But equally, we have some multi-day, fully immersive experiences, anything from Patua down in Tasmania with Walkalina, which you walk country for, I think it's up to 5 days, and really get to take in Tasmania and to hear it from the perspective of the traditional owners. And equally, at the other end of the country, we have tours that go out on country, you get to live in community for a number of days and really experience that firsthand. Obviously, at the moment, some of these tours, like the one in Arnhem Land, is not available because of some of the COVID restrictions and the need to keep community safe as a first priority. But we also have, tours over in the west, in Perth. There's some great tours around the city, so you can explore and see cities in perhaps a way you've never really seen them before. Even if you've lived in a city all your life, I think there's something magical about having a city revealed to you from an Aboriginal perspective and actually engaging and learning from that. There's so many different options. And I think one of the things that really jumps out to me is that there are things available that people just wouldn't expect or perhaps don't fit what might have been traditional views or molds of what Aboriginal tourism is. So there's so many different options, and we are bringing more and more people or operators onto our platform all the time. We currently have over 200 different experiences available, and I'm pretty confident within another 2 years we'll double that.
Who are your customers? Is it like mainly Australian audience, or is it more like tourists from overseas?
Given the time that we launched, you know, the travel into Australia has been quite restricted. And so predominantly, well, exclusively, our audience has been domestic. But we hope that as borders are starting to open, as people have that confidence to travel, and of course, as people are allowed to come into Australia, that we'll see a large international audience return. I think it's, you know, important to say that in the Aboriginal tourism industry, it's always, you know, well known that there's a high level of interest from internationals to explore Aboriginal culture when they come here. And unfortunately, most leave without having, you know, done that. So we hope to play a role in making sure that everybody that comes to this country who wants to have an Aboriginal experience gets to have one. And, you know, it's an ambitious kind of target, I guess, but I know on the industry, that's certainly the desire. But equally, I would love to see more Australians exploring country and really getting to know place.
And tourism is not the only outlet. There's also the retail side of Welcome to Country. How did that come about?
I think the magical word that everybody talks about during COVID was pivot. And I guess it also goes back to some of our original intentions of around how to use technology to assist, you know, Aboriginal entrepreneurs and businesses to be, you know, more successful and to really connect with the market. So we decided to do that pivot and launched an online store. And to be honest, when we first launched it, we just started selling Marcia Langton's travel guide, also called Welcome to Country. And within a week, we had sold over 100 copies of the book. And clearly there was an appetite from people for knowledge and products. And so we slowly started to assemble some things to be sold, and it's really taken on its own life from there. We now have product from all over the country, and we have over 1,000 different items that are available. And, you know, there's so much more out there. Hopefully we'll have more and more come on. But it's just one of those ways in which I think many people perhaps are, you know, been searching for ways in which they can support and looking for products and stuff. And again, for us, it's about creating something of size and scale that can really attract the audience to it and really help increase sales for businesses. So that was our intention. And it's really, like, we launched it in August 2020. So I think that might have been when Sydney had just come out of its first, you know, lockdown period. And so we just saw an increasing appetite from there. And I think when we saw, you know, things like Black Lives Matter really take off and the unfortunate, you know, death of George Floyd, people were hungry for information and wanting to know more. So we certainly saw more interest. And just this last Indigenous Business Month, which was in, you know, October last year, we saw an enormous response from the Australian public looking for Aboriginal products. And we think that, you know, it's a combination of factors that are delivering that. But I think it's also awesome to see that people are seeking out, you know, products from Aboriginal businesses or from businesses that are paying proper royalties to artists and stuff for their designs. So there's a real, you know, interest, and public are very educated about supporting the right things.
That was Jason Eads, CEO of Welcome to Country, talking to NITV Radio's Sharka Pekova.
NITV Radio, share our stories on Facebook.
Still to come on NITV Radio after the break, well, we'll see how a new Aboriginal walking tour has launched in Hobart, or Nipalona, as it's called in the local Aboriginal language, Palawa Kani. The tour follows in the footsteps of 40 Aboriginal resistance fighters in 1832 at the scene of one of Australia's most deadly wars between Aboriginal people and British colonists.
NITV Radio. Share our stories on Facebook.
Welcome back. Now, walking under Nipaluna's towering colonial buildings, Palawa Walpri woman Nunami Scalthorpe Green takes guests on an educational journey through the city. In 1832, a group of Tasmanian Aboriginal people walked these same steps through the city, hoping to meet with the state governor and end the Black War, a violent conflict between colonists and First Nations people. Ms. Scalthorpe Green says the tour is designed to help people better understand the history they can't see while walking through Hobart.
We follow the story of people like Manlagena, Wurudi, Traganini, Mithina, and then wherever there's sites that really link to some of our people, like Fanny Cochran-Smith, William Lanny, these are the sort of stories that come up, and those stories really spark us to talk about things like landscape changes, the Black War, Aboriginal bone collecting and ancestral repatriations. We talk about institutional changes and the way that institutions have treated our people over the years. And most importantly, we talk about our community's continued struggle and strength and activism and continuing presence in the city, as well as tying in some stories of landscape changes, and just a bit of my personal story as well is what sort of comes through, and people seem to remember that too.
Using the cityscapes, she connects the journey of those resistance fighters to the modern day achievements and activism of Tasmania's Aboriginal people. Ms. Scalthorpe Green again.
It's all about us still following in the same footsteps, and that's what I really was drawn to when I wanted to develop the tour. It was that I was standing in the same places as my old people.
The tour debuted last year as part of the 10 Days on the Island Festival, and due to its success is now part of the Theatre Royal's 2022 programme. Sarah Hamilton explains her role as a dramaturge.
A dramaturg is essentially a person who looks at all of the ingredients in something and takes a wide view and sees how everything pieces together. So in this situation, I guess I was looking at all the elements of story. And when I first came on board with the project, there were so many different ways that it could have gone, because Nunami has such a wealth of knowledge and story. So part of what we did together was to distill that and to find the essence of what the experience was going to be. Yeah, I think it's incredibly valuable that the Theatre Royal can offer something like this, because it is quintessentially part of this landscape. Like, this story is about the ground we're standing on right here, and I think it's really exciting to see this this space, this venue, hosting Tasmanian stories. I think it's really important for the future.
And as Simon Wellington, the chief executive of the Theatre Royal, says, the tour is unlike anything the theatre has offered before.
For us to be reaching outside the walls of the theatre, to be taking people out into the streets and really extending that idea of kind of what our conversation is with the city and what we can do.
Tourists and Tasmanians alike have embraced the tour, with six shows already selling out.
It gave me a completely different understanding of how my day-to-day life and how others have used this land.
So many of us were very ignorant about the true Tasmanian history.
Takara Nipaluna will run until the end of this year. And this story was produced by Sarah Mandas for SBS News. This beautiful song, Back Home, by Jason Owen and Tanya Kennigan. Well, that's all we have for today. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Bye.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.